Hey, deserving listeners, it's just me today. I thought I would talk about some recent movies that I've seen and TV shows and documentaries. Mainly, I want to talk about Black Klansmen and Crazy Rich Asians, because those are in the news cycle right now. So let me introduce the podcast. This is the podcast called Psychology in Seattle. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist, a professor, and also an avid movie watcher. This first movie is Black Klansmen, directed by Spike Lee, of course, produced by Spike Lee and Jordan Peele, among other people. Jordan Peele of Key and Peele fame. Written by Spike Lee and a few other people, and it's based on a book by Ron Stallworth, which is an autobiography, and the book is called Black Klansmen. And it stars John David Washington, who is the son of Denzel Washington. And I thought the lead actor in this movie was the I can't remember his name, but he's on SNL right now. I thought it was him. I thought he looked like him, but I was wrong. It's actually Denzel Washington's son, which is exciting to see. He doesn't particularly look like Denzel. It must look like his mom. Also starring Adam Driver, but he kind of sounds like his dad at times. He has a similar accent. I'm not sure where that accent comes from. Sounds sort of like Midwest. I'm not sure. Or Chicago. I'm not sure. Anyway. It also stars Adam Driver, who I love. I think he is one of the best actors of our time. He is also interesting if you can watch some interviews with him. Interesting life, interesting guy, and I just like him. Also stars Laura Harrier and Topher Grace, who incidentally plays David Duke and looks exactly like David Duke did back then. Also incidentally, back around the time that David Duke was in the news, I think he was running for president. He was running for nomination in 92-ish time during the election that Bill Clinton won. I believe David Duke was in the news as trying to get the nomination for the Republican ticket. But anyway, I hated David Duke and was, you know, very upset about the fact that he had any political power and that anyone was listening to him, because David Duke was a known Ku Klux Klansman. And that is obnoxious and horrible. It'd be like a Nazi running for office or something. It's like, no, that's one, fine, you can run, because surely no one will support a Ku Klux Klansman running for office. That's absurd, right? That's just like, there's no way that would happen. But of course it did, because it was in, I think, Louisiana. And so I wrote a song, actually, about David Duke, just called Duke, and it was a loud, angry song. Just, I can't remember the lyrics. I can kind of remember the guitar part. It had this lick that was up sort of high. Anyway, back in my college days. Rotten Tomatoes, Black Klansman gets 96%, which is, as you know, extremely high. Its budget was $15 million, just $15 million. So that is not much money for a movie. And at box office, $30 million, which surprises me. I would have thought it would be more, but I guess a lot of people aren't going to this movie, even though it's amazing. And it's a major movie, and Spike Lee, and blah, blah, blah. And it's entertaining. It's a fun movie. It's one of the most entertaining Spike Lee movies that he's ever made. And again, 96 Rotten Tomatoes. It's a fun movie. If you haven't seen it, I'm not gonna spoil it. I might spoil some little things in it, but there's not really much to spoil, because anyway, the point is that I'm trying to make is that it is a fun, funny, light but heavy, at sort of about, it's about a heavy topic, but it can be quite light at times or throughout the movie. I would say overall it's sort of a black comedy in some ways, but it's a real story. So it's like a black comedy about our life, about our society. It's mostly a true story about a black officer who works to infiltrate the KKK in Colorado. And David Duke, being of the national KKK organization, eventually works his way to Colorado. And there's some scenes there. Spike Lee. I just want to talk about Spike Lee's movies for a second, because I've been following him ever since he made Do the Right Thing. And I have liked him and liked his style and liked the envelopes that he pushing the envelope. And so I just want to talk about the movies that I like by him. I've seen most of his movies, but just starting in the beginning. So I saw Do the Right Thing when I was in college, early college, and I remember really liking it. I remember thinking it was like nothing I'd ever seen before, about a group of people I'd never seen a movie about before. The way that the conflicts and the heat, you know, it's the hottest day in Brooklyn, New York, and you got the pizza shop owner, and you got all these other people, and it's sort of a black comedy. I think Spike Lee does really well when it comes to that sort of movie. I guess in a way you could say that Black Klansman is almost like in a similar tone as Do the Right Thing in some ways, because there's like all these super absurd things that are happening in the movie, and you're just like, oh my God, is this happening right now? So that was my introduction, and then I remember Mo Betta Blues and Jungle Fever, and then Malcolm X, and so he made, those are four movies he made in a row. I mean, just look at that in terms of your, he had some movies before that, like he had School Days in 1988. I actually did not like that movie. I gave that a 4 out of 10. I might even give it lower than that. I mean, it's Spike Lee trying to find his place. And I think you can definitely see how he's developing his craft, but and you can see how it's like the precursor to Do the Right Thing. But I think he learned a lot of lessons when he made School Days, and then so he made School Days in 88. Then he makes Do the Right Thing in 89. Then he makes Mo Betta Blues in 90. Then he makes Jungle Fever in 91 and Malcolm X in 92. So in 4 years, he makes four of the most iconic movies in America: Do the Right Thing, Mo Betta Blues, Jungle Fever, Malcolm X. Malcolm X is amazing. I gave all four of these movies 7 out of 10. I might even give Malcolm X and Do the Right Thing a little higher. I'm not sure, if I haven't seen him in a while. Then Cricklin and Clockers. I really like Clockers in 95. I gave that a 7. He Got Game with Denzel, 98. And Allen is in that movie. Summer of Sam, 99. I also gave that a 7 as well. It's about the serial killer in New York, and about other people. Again, sort of a dark comedy. There's different sorts of people. You know, they had like these like really closed-minded Italian guys, and then anyway, I liked Summer of Sam. 25th Hour came out in 02 with Edward Norton. I originally loved this movie, and then I rewatched it within the last year and did not like it. I mean, it's got its good moments, but I gave it a 5 out of 10. Not a huge fan of that one. Inside Man with, I think, Clive Owen is in that movie. 7. I gave that a 7 out of 10. He made a lot of other movies recently that I haven't seen. He made Old Boy. He directed the American version of Old Boy. And I just have to say that it's boring to me. I know that people love this movie. They love the Korean version. I think it's Korean original. And I just don't get it. I don't get the appeal. It's boring. Black Klansman, I gave a 9. Out of all of Spike Lee's movies, I think Black Klansman is by far the best. It's Spike Lee at his best artistic expression. The movie is very clear and clean. Like a lot of his movies kind of get out of control and maybe that's the appeal to some people. They just like that the movie just gets, you know, just goes off the rails, or how it kind of gets chaotic and has sort of weird, chunky moments and rough edges to the movies. But Black Klansman is very slick. The movie, you know, there's I can't think of any rough edges to that movie. It's a very clean story. It's very cleanly directed. It's understandable. It's a true story. There's nothing crazy about it. It's just, you know, it just tells this very interesting real story. I mean, that's the thing. It's a real story, and it's a very interesting real story. I also think that the way that the writing and the directing and the acting came together, it's just a masterpiece, I think. It's probably going to be in, you know, one of my, it's probably going to be in my top three movies of the year, I'm guessing. I just really liked it. I don't know about the rewatchability of the movie, honestly, but as an experience going, because I didn't really know what to expect. I had an idea of what the premise was, but as I was watching it, I was like, man, this is a fun movie. I am having a fun time. And then there were these moments where you just have these profound emotional experiences regarding race in our country. I mean, there are just these spikes of just like bone-chilling expressions by a master of directing, and you just get this sense of just like, oh my goodness. I mean, there's this moment where a speaker comes to town, a African-American activist gives this speech, and that whole scene is just so masterful. There's all these decisions that Spike Lee makes in the crafting of that scene that it's beautiful. And then there's a scene with Harry Belafonte juxtaposed to these other scenes that are happening that is also just, I mean, in 100 years, I suspect that when they look at cinema of our decade or the first half of our century, there will be scenes out of this movie that people will know. They'll be like, oh, you know, of course that one scene. You know, it's like when we look at movies from the mid-20th century, you think of Humphrey Bogart, you know, Play It Again. And, you know, we always had Paris. You know, there's just certain scenes that you just really say, oh, okay, you know. Or you think, you know, I Am Your Father. You know, there's certain scenes where, or the opening scene to Saving Private Ryan, for example. And I'm worried, though, because I feel like not enough people are going to see this movie because they think it's, you know, a depressing, sad movie, or they don't want to, you know, they're sort of overloaded on black rights or something. And I just have to say that, I don't know, like, see it. It's good. It's fun. That's the thing about it. It's not beating you over the head. There are moments where you could argue it's beating you over the head, but it's done in such a natural, well-produced, well-directed, well-acted way that you just doesn't feel like it's beating you over the head. I mean, for me anyway, I felt like I was transported in those scenes. And there's several moments like that where it just feels, I don't know. I thought it was good. So, 9 out of 10 for me. Some people are criticizing the movie because they say that it's too nice to white people. Because basically in the story, you have a black cop who lives in a mostly white community in Colorado, and he is in a police force, and he's the first black guy on the police force. It's all white people. And so he, you know, there's some discrimination there, and then he decides to infiltrate the local chapter of the KKK. And of course, it's all white people in the KKK. And so the movie isn't like a bunch of black people. There's not a lot of black characters in the real, this is a real story. You know what I mean? So, and what ends up happening is that the black cop ends up befriending and getting allies in the police force who are white to help him fight the KKK. And the way it comes across is that some white people are bad and some white people are good. And so there's or some white people are on the wrong side of politics and some white people are on the right side of politics. And so some people are criticizing it because they basically make the cops out to be mostly good. And they think that that's unrealistic. You know, they think that cops are much more likely to be bad and racist and this kind of thing. Because essentially, the white police force, for the most part, supports the black police officer in his attempts to infiltrate the KKK and find out information. Also, the way that Spike Lee or the writers decided to write the KKK members, they seem pretty exaggerated. You know, they're sort of cartoonish. Think of like, you know, Southern yokel idiots who hate black people. You know, it's just real characterization, real cartoonish. And so they criticize that because what the critics are basically saying is like, this lets white people off the hook. And honestly, from the little bit of, you know, reading I did, it was all white people who were saying this, by the way. I didn't see any black people saying this. It was all white people saying, and maybe black people are, but I only saw white people who were saying that, you know, they would write in the article as a white person, blah, blah, blah. And they were saying that this movie lets white people off the hook because it makes white audience members able to identify with the good white cops rather than identifying with these cartoonish KKK people. And what the critics are saying is like, well, you know, white people in the audience shouldn't be left off the hook so easily. You know what I mean? And really, there's something about that argument that it just really bothers me. I mean, one, why do white people have to identify with the bad guys? You know, why does a movie about a black police officer who investigates the KKK successfully, by the way, with the help of white cops? I mean, it's clear in the movie that this is the black police officer's mission to do this. Like, he's the one who instigates the whole thing. He's the one who does the whole thing. And he gets white people on his side, you know? And so it's this, you know, it shows a lot of agency for the black cop because that's what really happened, apparently. You know, this guy wrote this book. And so anyway, when we make a movie about this real story, why should one of the main messages or main purposes be to make white audience members feel like shit? I mean, who may or may not be guilty of such things. We are all guilty of racism, black and white people, by the way. Now, of course, white people are more problematic because they hold the power and their racism towards blacks produces much more harm to black people, for sure, just because of a majority and also white people being in places of power and keeping white people in places of power, for sure. I mean, it's not an equal thing, but we're all guilty of racism. Asians are, black people are, white people are. Everyone is guilty of racism. So why should the black people, you know, why should the white audience members? I don't know. It just seems like a weird criticism to me, particularly because what I believe the movie did is the beauty of this movie, and I think it's a combination of the way it was written and the way it was directed, is that you get a real sense of what it's like to live in America, I guess, is the thing. It's like there's nuance to it. There are people who turn the other way. There are people who actively work against other people. There are politicians that are very slick, and then you have like the yokels who aren't very slick, and you have the systems of power, and you have you know, black people that are trying to make a difference, and they're sticking together, and then they have their own prejudices about other people. Like Spike Lee has always been good about, and this is why Do the Right Thing is so great, because in some way he helps everyone to, he gives everyone a chance, I guess, is the thing. And you get a sense that Spike Lee has affection for everyone in the film, even one of the KKK members. So the local chapter of the KKK, the leader of that local chapter is portrayed, I think, pretty well. I mean, not well, but favorably or likable. comes off as likable. Certainly, there are other KKK members that are that come across as very unlikable and comedically unlikable. But anyway, so to say that, like, because essentially what these critics are saying is like, all the white cops should have been working actively against the black cop or something, or the KKK members shouldn't have been so comedically racist. But to me, I mean, the gestalt of this movie, I just have to say, is not that the KKK or racism is over, by the way. Like, when the final 5 minutes of this movie is so intense, that this thing, because what he basically does, Spike Lee, is he skips forward in time to now, and he shows real footage of KKK and neo-Nazis doing horrible things. And it's just this onslaught of like, oh my God, this is still happening, you know, and because you're watching this whole movie and it's like, oh, isn't this quaint? This happened so long ago. Weren't they so stupid back then to have KKK? And oh, it was so funny back then. And oh, so silly. And then all of a sudden, boom, Spike Lee is just shoving stuff in your face. These news clips, real news clips. And you're like, oh my God, this is still happening. I mean, it's like I said, it's just bone chilling. And the way that he edits and the sound design and all that at the end is just so powerful. I mean, I was deeply moved by this movie. I mean, the way that it all comes across. So the gestalt of this movie is not that we're off the hook. You know, it's not that white people, you don't get the sense that white people are somehow off the hook. The other thing about the whole thing that this movie portrays, I think accurately, is many white people have participated in the fight for racial equality. Many white people have even died for racial equality. When Martin Luther King marched in Selma, there were many white people who marched right by him, and there were some white people who were even murdered in that effort. In and around the Selma bridge incident, there were many people who were murdered, including some white people. Some of the people who died in those marches, in those efforts, were white people who knowingly put themselves in front of danger because they wanted to fight for racial equality. Racial equality and racism is all of our problem. We all have to work on it. It's not just for black people, okay? It is all of our problem. And white people, since the beginning of slavery in our country, have been fighting for it. I've learned that I come from Quakers. I have a pretty strong Quaker lineage that goes back to the 1600s in emigrating from the UK to the United States, and they hated slavery. They never owned slaves, and they spoke up against slavery. They snuck slaves out of the South on the Underground Railroad to the North. And these people were putting themselves in harm's way, and I'm sure many were harmed by government or by slave owners or whatever. And, there's always been white people. Now, were there enough white people? No, there should have been more white people. And of course, you had white people who stole actual human beings from Africa and dragged them across the ocean to put them in generations of slavery. And, you know, those were white people doing awful things. But it's not as if white people haven't been fighting. And so in this movie, you get that sense of like, okay, at the center, you have a black man who is fighting for black rights, and he manages to get other white people to fight with him. And the other thing is it's not as if white people don't experience marginalization and harm. Adam Driver plays a Jewish character, and you get the sense like, well, yeah, I mean, the KKK hates my people too, and so I'm all for this, you know. So it's not white, black people aren't the only targets, right? And sometimes white identities are absolutely in line. I mean, just, you know, think about World War II. Anyway, so along this line, a student of mine was just telling me a story about that they had heard. And there's a neighborhood near, or there's an island near Seattle, or called Vashon Island, and they had heard, the student had heard the story about how this Japanese family had grown strawberries out there and had done something kind of interesting in terms of the practice of strawberry farming or something. But then during World War II, they were imprisoned by the government of the United States because of racism. And when they got back, they managed to get their farm back. And I was guessing that white people on Vashon Island must have preserved the farm for them while they were imprisoned, because in other communities that didn't happen. And so so there's many stories of – and so this is what I want to say. The story of World War II and Japanese Americans being imprisoned, American citizens born in the United States being imprisoned by the federal government without hardly any protest by white people, by the way. There's many things to say about white people in America in response to that. Most people did nothing. And then there were a small amount of white people who actually made it happen, right? You have Franklin Delano Roosevelt and other people who actually pushed for this sort of thing. And so so you have a small number of white people who got it done. You had you also had a number of white people who hated Japanese people and were very scared of them and racist against them and attacked them and wouldn't hire them and, you know, would burn their, you know, houses down. And then you have a vast sea of white people that did nothing, either because they didn't care or they were passively racist or scared of doing anything. But then you have a small number of white people during World War II who actually actively helped Japanese American citizens by either doing legal things or preserving the property of Japanese Americans while they were being imprisoned, or by helping them get out once they were, you know, there were a lot of things. So you have the full breadth. So you can't just say, oh, white people need to feel like shit because of what happened in World War II. No. What we need to say is that there was a wide variety of responses from white people during World War II to the imprisonment of Japanese Americans, and it's the same when it came to and when it comes to black-white relations in the United States. You have the same spectrum. You have some white people who are actively fighting against equal rights. You have some who are just passively letting it happen. You have some who are unknowingly letting it happen. And then you have some white people who are actively fighting against racial inequality and putting their lives on the line. And so this movie portrays that. You have all those characters. Now, what some critics would say is, well, there weren't enough bad white people in the movie. And, you know, I guess you could make that argument. But to me, the movie needed to make some sacrifices in that reality in order to make it entertaining, I guess, because I was just trying to think like, well, where would you put a white person in there that was of that sort? And it's just like there weren't enough characters to provide that anyway. Okay. So again, just to conclude about this movie, it's uplifting in a way. It's also simultaneously terrifying. It's very moving. There's when the activist is giving a speech, that's one of the most like amazing scenes I've ever seen in a movie. And then all the stuff that happens at the end, including the news clips, is just like this whirlwind of reactivity for me. Very moving. It's a funny movie, and I think it's educational too. I think you can learn about. I learned how the KKK works in some ways because I didn't really know how. You know, I don't know much about it, and so you get some behind the scenes looks to the KKK, you know, and about domestic terrorism in some ways. Okay, so that is that movie. Let's take a break. When we get back, I'll talk about Crazy Rich Asians. All right, we're back from the break. All right, let's talk about Crazy Rich Asians. Directed by John Chu, who is Taiwanese-American, born in California. John Chu directed this movie. He's mainly known for directing the Step Up movies, of which I didn't know until looking it up that there are several Step Up movies. The Step Up movies are about dancing. I think they're rom-coms. I think I've seen the first one. I think the first one has Channing Tatum in it. And it's all about – it's rom-coms about dancing. And if you're into that sort of thing, then you probably love those movies and you know all about John Chu. And if you're not, then you have no idea who John Chu was, just like I didn't. John Chu also directed Now You See Me 2, which if it was anything like the first one, I'm sure it was an atrocity. And he also directed Gem and the Holograms, a real, you know, non-animated, real-life version of Gem and the Holograms, if you remember that cartoon back in the day. Crazy Rich Asians, the movie was based on a book by Kevin Kwan of the same name. It stars Constance Wu. I want to talk about Constance for a little bit. So she's the center of the movie. You know, so the movie, again, I'm going to not spoil much because there's not really much to spoil, but the movie is about a Chinese American girl who was born in the United States, and she meets a Chinese fella who is very rich, and he invites her to Singapore to a wedding, his like best friend's wedding, and this American Chinese girl gets to meet his family, who are all these crazy people, and she gets to meet all these crazy rich, crazy and rich people in Singapore, and she, you know, it's a fish out of water rom-com essentially. So Constance Wu, the girl, she is at the center of all this. And, you know, needs to carry most of the movie. And she's amazing. She's an amazing actress. I mean, just there's this one scene where she's really sad and she has to cry. And it seemed so real to me. I mean, there's a certain way that people cry in movies that always, I can always tell. It's like, oh, this is what they do when they act cry. There's a way that when you actually, like the next time you actually see a human being cry in your real life, like if you're a therapist and you have a client or something, I feel like I see people cry every day as a therapist and as a professor, you know, students and clients and supervisees are crying all the time, which is great because emotion is good. And I have a lot of experience seeing people actually cry, and I can. There's a big gap between that, you know, the way people actually cry and the way people cry in movies. Well, the way Constance Wu cries in this movie, it seemed so genuine. It must have been some heavy method acting from her in those situations, because it was just like, because the thing that, you know, maybe if you're not a movie sort of behind the scenes buff like I am, the thing that always makes it hard for these actors to do this sort of thing and do it well is that for these big budget movies, they often will, you know, you're sitting in your, you're an actress, you're sitting in your trailer and you're getting your makeup on and, you know, someone's doing your hair and you're tired and you're waiting around and, you know, and then someone comes to you and says, you know, you got half an hour till your scene, and you're like, okay. And then some gets delayed because some light doesn't work. And so 2 hours later, you get dragged onto the set and you're sort of like, wait, what am I doing? What's my character? Because you're you. And then now it's okay. Now you have to suddenly become this other character. And then you sit down, and then there's all these directors and assistant directors and key grips and camera guys and light guys and sound guys and, you know, set guys and script people. And, you know, there's just all these people, and they're all just, and all those people are just kind of wandering around living their lives, trying to do a job, but they don't really care about you and your stupid scene. They're just, you know, they're just thinking about how do I get through this day? 'Cause I'm at work. And so everyone's in different states of emotion, and the director, you know, might have a lot of different things on their mind. You know, the lens has to be just right, or the lighting seems a little funny, or there's an airplane flying overhead that's driving everyone crazy. And so you come onto the scene, and now you have to all of a sudden, you know, go act, and you have to somehow, like, one, act; two, remember your lines; three, you have to act in line with the last scene that was in the script, which might actually not be shot until 5 weeks later. You know, you might shoot the movie in reverse because of budgetary and production issues. And so you have to somehow know, like, where am I in the story right now? And what would my character, where would that my character's emotional arc be in this situation? And there are just several moments in this movie where I just saw this just wonderful Asian face acting so well. Like, there's a certain genuineness, I would say, I guess, that she brings to acting. Like, you get a sense that it's a real character there, and you can tell that she puts in little quirks and mannerisms that no director could tell you to do, you know. So I just thought she was great. And it was even more apparent because the acting around her is just so, some of it is so bad. I mean, it's written bad and acted bad, and I think directed bad. I mean, so to cut to the chase, I liked this movie for the most part, but there were some parts of this movie that I just thought were so boring and so melodramatic. I'll get to that in a second. But, I mean, it's a rom-com, so what are you going to do, I guess? But I don't know. There are good rom-coms. I feel like rom-coms have gotten better and better and better. I mean, you could argue that, like, Trainwreck was a rom-com, right? And there were, you know, that was a really funny, touching, you know, fast-paced movie that didn't have a lot of clunky moments. Well, Crazy Rich Asians has some just huge swaths of horrible, horrible movie making, in my opinion, writing wise anyway. Anyway, so Constance Wu was amazing, and I am excited to see her in future things. For those who don't know who I'm talking about, she is most famous, I think, for the TV comedy Fresh Off the Boat, which is a funny movie or funny TV show. She plays the mom. She is arguably the star of that show. I don't know. And then the romantic interest is played by a man named Henry Golding. So this movie, Crazy Rich Asians, is very, you know, people are seeing it a lot now. And so all of a sudden, people are stopping me on the street and saying, I look like this guy. I mean, at first, so I'll tell you my little journey with this. So at first, I had a white relative, an older white relative, come to me a few days ago and say, "You look just like the guy in Crazy Rich Asians." And coming from a white person, I'm always like, "Oh boy!" Like, all Asians look alike to white people. And, you know, I just figured that it was that. I was like, there's no way I look like that guy. Like, one, I'm not good looking enough to be in a movie of that sort. So I'm guessing it's just because I'm Asian, and therefore it's believed that I look just like this guy. So I ignored it. I actually didn't even look up his picture because I just figured there's no way I look anything like him. And then I'm walking down the street, and a total stranger, and an Asian person, by the way, full Asian person. I think she was Filipino. I'm not sure. She stops me on the street and says, "Oh my God, you look just like the guy from Crazy Rich Asians. And I'm like, huh, maybe I better look up this guy's face because maybe I look like him. And yeah, I would say that in terms of the shape of my skull is similar to his. And I mean, so he's half Asian, by the way. So a lot of us half Asians look alike. You know, there's just certain qualities that you get in a face when you mix Asian DNA with white DNA. And one of the versions that you get is a face like mine, which is apparently a face like Henry Golding's. Anyway, and I'll get more into the halfness of that in a second. Gemma Chan, Awkwafina, Nico Santos is in this movie, and he is from the TV show Superstore, which I enjoy quite a lot. There's not a lot. I don't watch a lot of TV, like where you sit down and you go to your, you know, your recorded shows and watch something. And Superstore is, I guess, probably one of the only TV shows that I watch besides The Americans, but that's over now. But anyway, Nico Santos is from that show. So if you're a fan of Superstore, you know what I'm talking about. He's great in that. Lisa Liu plays the grandma. You might remember her from Joy Luck Club. Ken Jeong from Community and the Hangover movies. He's hilarious. Michelle Yeoh, you might remember from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And Jimmy Yang is in this movie. You might remember him from Silicon Valley and also from his stand-up comedy acts. Budget, $30 million, and box office so far is $53 million. I'm sure it's going to go up from there. Rotten Tomatoes gives its 93%. I think this is overblown because I gave it a 6 out of 10. I might even, if I watch it again, I'm guessing it would even go down to like a 5 out of 10 or something. I mean, to me, a 6 out of 10 means it's a good movie. It means absolutely watchable. You're going to enjoy yourself for the most part. It's not going to be a waste of time. But it's not a masterpiece by any stretch of the imagination. And like I said, there are some rom-coms that I think can be actually masterpieces. I thought Trainwreck was hilarious and moving and interesting, and I don't know. There's other rom-coms that are like that as well that I can't think of off the top of my head. So yeah, 93% on Rotten Tomatoes. I mean, that is strange to me given the clunkiness and the melodramaticness of this movie. I think that it's overblown due to two factors. One, I think people are sick of heavy movies. And I think that when people go to this movie, they're like, okay, it's an all Asian cast. And, there's going to be a lot of talk about racism and how white people are terrible and stuff. And there's some of that. There's like, it kind of starts with that. Like there's this scene in the beginning that's kind of like that. But for the most part, the whole movie, it's just a straight up rom-com. Like you could replace all those characters with white people and it wouldn't really change the story at all. Like you could make them all like crazy New York or crazy Long Island white people or something. And it would have been like the exact same story and all the beats would have been the same. I mean, certainly there are elements to this movie that make it particularly Chinese, but the food and the games they play and the kind of some of the things they talk about. But really, I mean, this is an American rom-com so I think people are like sick of all the heavy movies and they just want to sit down and watch something easy. And also I think that they thought it might not be easy. And so I think a lot of people are like, oh my God, this is a great movie. Cause I think, there aren't a lot of easy movies, lately. Also, I think people are upping their rating because they feel bad for us Asians. You know, I'm just imagining a white movie reviewer for the Chicago Sun-Times or whatever, and he goes to this movie and he's just like, okay, you know, it's got its rough moments, but man, I mean, what a great movie to see in our times where it's just like filled with Asians and it's a movie about American Asians and it's fun and it's not boring and it's not preachy and it's not And it doesn't have a token white person at the center. Like, how great is that? And so I think it's getting bumped way up in the Rotten Tomatoes ratings because of that. I think a similar thing happened with Black Panther. And I remember talking about this. Black Panther is a legit good action movie. You know, it's a legit good hero movie. But again, I think the Rotten Tomato score was something like 97% or something. And I was just like, what? Like there are, it's a great movie, but it's not Citizen Kane or whatever, you know, it's not Empire Strikes Back. It's, you know, it's a solid action hero movie, but because it involves, you know, mostly black people and the celebration and the freedom that is given to black people when you give them an entire movie, you know, similar to this movie, Crazy Rich Asians. It's like, it's so great to see Asians just being themselves, you know, they don't have to be that token Asian foreigner person who's really good with computers. You know, it's just like, you got all the characters, you got the douchebag Asians and you got the old Asians and the young Asians and the straight-laced Asians and the nice Asians and the dutiful Asians and the good friend Asians and the bad friend Asians. And it's just nice to see, you know, and so I commend it for that reason, for sure. I mean, as an Asian person, my God, it's just like, it feels great. But on the other hand, it's like, I don't think it deserves a 93% rating. I just don't think it's that good. So, it's a rom-com. And like I said, it feels really great to see Asians in a lot of different characters. And it's similar to when I saw Mulan 20 years ago. And I was like, oh my God, a Disney movie about people like me. I mean, it was very moving to me. I remember watching Mulan 20 years ago, and like half of the movie I was crying. There's something deep when you finally see something that represents you. And if you're a white person out there, I hope you can really hear me on this. And maybe you have some, like if you're a lesbian, you probably have a similar experience when you watch a lesbian movie, a movie that's made for lesbians, you know, that's about lesbians for lesbians. You know, if you're a white person from that lives on a ranch, for example, and there's a movie about someone who lives on a ranch, like it just feels like, oh my God, like even if the movie isn't that good, there's just something really great about seeing those sorts of movies, you know? And for me, it's often been around Asians. And it doesn't matter if it's not, I'm Japanese, okay? So this is a Chinese movie. Mulan is a movie about a Chinese story. And somehow it's like, well, it's close enough, I guess, even though it's like, you know, for me to identify with Chinese people would be the same as like someone from Ohio, a white person from Ohio identifying with Mexicans or something. You know, it's even more drastic than that. There's a vast difference in culture and identification between Japanese and Koreans and Filipino and Chinese and Taiwanese and, you know, people who live in Singapore and people who live in Guam and people who live in Hawaii. You know, there are just huge differences between these people. And as I've said before, when you say, oh, that person's Asian, you're literally referring to more than half of the world's population. You know, like I've said before, like when we have those surveys and you have to fill out your race, you know, you have white and you have white non-Hispanic and then you have Hispanic, white Hispanic, and then you have black, and then you have Native American, and then you have Asian. And to say Asian, that accounts for, like I said, more than half the population on the planet, especially, you know, when you're including South Asian people. But even if you're just including East Asian people, you're talking about a third of the planet. And it would be the same thing as if you said, I am from the Americas. Like if, like say you're in China and they ask you for your race and they have one box and it just says North and South America. Like, you're just from North or South America. And you're from, you know, Ohio. You're a white person from Ohio. And you're like, wait a second. So are people in Chile and people in Cuba and people in Jamaica and people in Mexico and people in Canada and Native Americans in Alaska, like, we all check this same box? Well, that's what it's like when you say Asian. But anyway, since there are so few representations of Asians in movies and other kinds of things, when I finally see something like this, it really affects me. I mean, I went through a time when I watched a bunch of John Woo movies, remember, with Chow Yun-fat and all the action-y movies. I mean, these are like absurd action movies. And not really my thing, but I loved it because it was just like Asians just, you know, just going for it in a movie. Like, there's no white person at the center, no token white person. I mean, that was actually one problem I had with Black Panther, was that they still had to get a white person in there. And I realized that there was some tongue in cheek there. You know, it's like, oh, you gotta, you know, he's the one out of water, you know. But on the other hand, I was just like, why? You know, just, if you're going to go for it, go for it. Do the whole thing, you know, and that's what Crazy White Asian movie does. It's just like, there's no white people at all. I mean, I'm trying to think if, I think there was like one white person who was sort of like in the background in one scene. But anyway, and obviously when they're in the States, there's white people, but okay. So one thing I noticed was I sit down and I've got my popcorn. I'm ready to go. I always bring popcorn with me. Is that wrong? I love Aaron's popcorn. Aaron's popcorn is just, there's nothing. I've eaten a lot of popcorn in my life, and Aaron's popcorn is just by far superior. Like, whatever second is a very distant second. Anyway, I bring my own soda as well. Is that weird? I just like to bring my own soda. What, you know, what are you going to do? So I'm in the movie theater. And I like this new trend of reserve seating and those recliner seats. Like, there's this old movie theater by my place called Oak Tree. I think it's still called Oak Tree. I'm not sure. It's in North Seattle. And it's been around for, I don't know, 20, 30 years. And for many years, it had those regular seats. And they recently switched over to the recliner reserve seats, and man, it's so great. I just love that. Kick back, you know, you got that button that, you know, you recline back, and you can sort of spread out, because there's nothing worse than being in a crowded movie and someone's right, you know, you got two people right next to you and like someone's breathing really heavily. I remember I was watching this one movie and this guy was breathing so loudly, and I was like, what's wrong? How come it's so loud? Like, it's just right in my ear. Anyway, I shouldn't be mean. Maybe there's some kind of condition that the guy had. Who knows? But anyway, so I sit down with my popcorn and my soda, and the previews come on. And right away, I'm like, oh, you know how normally, like, if you're the previews are usually geared toward the audience of the movie, right? So if it's an action movie, you'll see previews of action movies. If it's a horror movie, you'll see previews of horror movies, right? And as soon as this movie started, I was like, well, are they going to do rom-coms, or what are they going to do here? Because it's, you know, it's an Asian rom-com. So what's going to happen? Well, the first one was, they start off with John Cho's new movie, which is like a thriller. His daughter gets kidnapped or something, and it looks pretty interesting. John Cho, he plays Sulu in the new Star Trek. He also was in Harold and Kumar. It looks interesting. So I was like, oh, okay, that's what they're going to do. They're going to show Asian movies at the beginning of an Asian-American movie, which I thought to be kind of bothersome, because it's like, you know, it'd be like you show a white horror movie and then you just and then you show a white rom-com in the preview just because it's white people, you know. It's just like, ugh. But anyway, so they show this John Cho movie, and I'm like, okay, yeah, that's probably correct, that people who are seeing Crazy Rich Asians on average are probably more likely to see John Cho's movie. Anyway, so that was interesting. Then after the John Cho's the movie preview proceeds to play an all black movie, all black cast. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. So they think that non-white people are seeing this movie, and so therefore they're more likely to see this African-American movie. And then the second preview was also an African-American cast movie. And the third movie, and the fourth preview, and the fifth preview, it was all African-American previews. So they start off with the John Cho, and then it's all African-American previews. And, you know, by the fourth one, it was depressing because, one, I'm thinking, because they obviously were looking for, like, other Asian-American movies to preview, and they could only come up with one. There's only one. And then they're like, well, what else do we got to preview before Crazy Rich Asians? Well, how about we just go with any person of color? Because honestly, I don't think Asian Americans are the target market for African American movies. Like, I think the target market for African American movies are African Americans. Like, now it shouldn't be that way. Like, everyone should just go to see movies regardless of the race, right? But in terms of, like, marketing wise, in terms of the likelihood of someone going to a movie, I mean, maybe Asian Americans are slightly more likely to go to an African American movie than a white person would. But I don't know. That's not my sense. So I don't know. It just was a kind of a sad commentary, you know, because there's been a lot of talk in the media and at the Oscars about underrepresentation of black people in Hollywood, right? It's like, oh, the first black, you know, director to win this thing, it's been this long and stuff. And I'm like, well, what, Asians aren't even being talked about. Like, we're not even being talked about, or we're barely being talked about in terms of how underrepresented we are. And, you know, and so it's like, in a time when it's fairly obvious that African Americans are underrepresented in Hollywood, and yet there are many movies focused on African Americans. There's not enough, but there are many. You know what I mean? Like, and the other thing is that I started thinking about as these previews were happening was, I was like, it would be a fun game to just walk up to someone and say, okay, rattle off as many white actors and actresses that you can think of, you know, Meryl Streep, Robert De Niro, Edward Norton, you know, you just start rattling off all these white people. And then you say, okay, tell me as many black actors as you can think of, you know, Idris Elba and Denzel Washington. And, you know, you just start naming all these black people. And then you go, okay, Asian actors, name as many Asian actors as you could. I would venture to say the vast majority of Americans couldn't name a single Asian actor, not one. Okay. I would have a hard time, you know, and that's because, you know, I don't get a chance to see much of it, but I'd be able to name some, right? Anyway, so it's just kind of an interesting situation. On the other hand, I'm not one of those people that's just like, well, we need to pass legislation to make Hollywood make more Asian movies. You know, I think there are bigger fish to fry, honestly, like in terms of problems we have in our society. I don't think that making Hollywood more representative is like the top of our list in terms of what we need to be focusing on regarding social justice. I think there are people on this planet who are currently, they don't have the luxury to even think about the racism they're experiencing because they don't have food, or they don't have clean water, or they don't have medical care, or they have to work 12 hours a day for, you know, 7 days a week, or they don't have enough education to tell them to wear a condom when they're having sex. I mean, there are people on the planet who are being told, like, really horrible things that are affecting their lives and their communities, and we're just ignoring that. You know, like, I did that episode about that woman in Saudi Arabia who wrote me and told me about what it's like to be a woman in Saudi Arabia and how horrible it is there, and for her, and how the legal system is essentially slavery. Essentially, every woman in Saudi Arabia is owned by a man, and he can do anything he wants to her, and he has total control over her life. And it, I sort of knew about that, but upon reading the specifics from this listener who wrote in, I was like, oh my God, like, because, you know, when you hear about news stories, you're like, oh yeah, it's happening far away. But when someone actually communicates with you directly and says, this is what my life is like, it just, you get a real sense for it. And anyway, so if as a society, I'd much rather have us focus on stuff like that than on Hollywood representation. I think it's important, Hollywood, and it affects things, you know, because it gives role models and it changes people's opinions about different groups when they're exposed to them and all that. That's great. And they're much bigger fish to fry, in my opinion. All right. Crazy Rich Asians, I thought was good because the story is a very Asian story. You have over-controlling parents who focus on tradition too much, according to American notions, and the parents focus on materialism too much and on how things look too much, again, according to Americans. It's very Asian story in that the kids actually truly want to please their parents. Like if this movie was made with an American sensibility, they're so I won't ruin the movie, but essentially the climax of the movie involves not the relationship between the girl and the guy. So most rom-coms, there's a girl and a guy, they fall in love, they have some major crisis in their relationship, they break up, and then the very end of the movie, they get back together, right? Well, this rom-com is you know, it's no different than that. I'm not spoiling anything because you've seen the formula a billion times. But the difference with this movie, I think, is that it says it in a very Chinese way, in that it isn't that the climax is not between the boy and the girl. The climax is between the girl and the boy's mother. That's the climax of the movie. And it's done in a very Chinese way too, over mahjong, and it's just really it's really great in that way. And it's also a very Asian story because there's tons of people, and they're all invited. That's the thing about a lot of Asians, is that you invite everybody. You don't, like, I find that white people, not always, but you know, people from Northwest Europe, they kind of know their cousins, but not really. And when they have a birthday party, you know, they invite a couple people maybe. And they might not even invite all their siblings, you know. They'll just be like, you know, I'll just invite my brother. You know, I'm sure my sister doesn't need to be there. My Japanese family and most of the Asians that I know, if you have a birthday party, you invite everybody. You invite distant cousins. You invite all your grandparents. You invite, you know, your neighbors. You know, you don't. You invite everybody. It's just, you know, it's just the norm. And so family get-togethers are mammoth. And you just get food. You get a lot of food, way too much food. You just go to a place and you eat and drink and laugh and talk for hours. Like I've talked about this before, when my Japanese American relatives come to Seattle from out of town, we'll just go to the Japanese grocery store in Seattle. It's this big grocery store downtown Wajimaya. And we just go to the grocery store and we'll hang out there for 5 hours because it has a deli and a bookstore and all this kind of stuff. But we kind of post up at the deli. There's places you can sit to eat, like a cafeteria kind of place. It'd be like if you're Swedish American, and when your Swedish American relatives come in from out of town, you just go to the IKEA and you go to the where they serve meatballs, and you just sit there and hang out there for 5 hours. I mean, it is exactly like that. And occasionally you go look at some stuff and, oh, maybe I'll buy a new dresser, I don't know. And you know, it's just this, and I've seen white people react to it, that I've sort of let into this, you know, inner circle. and they'll just be like, man, you have a big family. and I'm like, well, my family isn't actually big. It's just that they always show up and we always invite them. And I find that white people, it's just like, they just, in general, certainly there are white people that do this, but in general. So this movie exemplifies that by just having a lot of characters. Like, I read one review that where they're like, I lost track of who was who in the movie. And I found it to be very easy to keep track of who was who. I think it's possible that some white people are losing track because they think everyone looks the same. Because, you know, in other movies, like American movies, you know, you'll have like the dark haired guy and the blonde guy and maybe the black guy and maybe the Asian guy, you know, whereas this movie, it's all Asians. And so if you're not familiar with how to identify Asian faces, you might think they might start to kind of blend in. But you know, since I'm more accustomed to Asian faces, it wasn't that hard for me to keep track. And the other thing about this movie that I thought was interesting in talking to some other people was that, again, older white relative came to me and said, oh, you look just like the lead character. And I knew nothing about the movie. I think I'd seen a preview kind of once and thought, I immediately thought this wasn't the sort of movie I'd want to see. And honestly, it still isn't. I mean, the fact that if it didn't have a bunch of Asians in it, I'd never would have saw this movie because it's not really my cup of tea. This sort of silly rom-com that's not that interesting, you know. But anyway, but people love it. So, you know, like I said, 90-something percent on Rotten Tomatoes. So don't listen to me. Definitely go see it. I think it's worth seeing. But anyway, why was I talking about that? Oh, so I asked my white relatives, older relatives, I was like, so I don't know anything about this movie. You know, what sort of Asians are they? Are they Japanese? Are they Chinese? Are they Korean? You know, what are they? And they didn't know. They're like, oh, I think it takes place in Singapore. And I was like, well, that doesn't help me at all because there are lots of different types of Asians in Singapore. And so I was like, huh, isn't that interesting? And then I thought, when I go to the movie, maybe they kind of muddy the waters there to make it unclear what sort of Asians they are. Well, then I go to the movie and there are several moments where it is explicitly stated that these are Chinese people. I mean, they literally say Chinese or, you know, from China, you know, there's several scenes where it's like that. And I just find it funny that like some white people walk out of the movie and they're like, huh, you know, those were just like Asians, right? The other part about this is like, you know, it's played by a bunch of Western Asians, right? Asians that are born outside of Asia, raised in either the UK or United States or somewhere else. And yet they're playing people who live in Asia. So it'd be like, you know, you have a bunch of African Americans playing people who live in South Africa or something. You know, it's fine by me. It's, you know, it's a silly movie. It's fine, but it's just another part of it. Anyway, so Harry Golding, he's half white and half Malaysian, and his Malaysian descent has a couple races in there as well. Because, you know, just saying you're Malaysian doesn't necessarily mean much. Just like saying you're American, it's like, well, there's different races in America. And there's been a controversy, a lot of angry tweets, even from famous Asians, saying that they're upset because the main guy character, Henry Golding, is half Asian like I am, and yet he's playing a full Chinese guy. I mean, I get it. I get that problem. It's like, you're making a movie about Chinese people, and the lead dude in the movie is not only not Chinese, but he's only half Asian. He's like half white. He's half white English. And that was another problem that I was seeing on write-ups about this movie. Is like they'd be like, he's half English and he's half Malaysian. And I'm like, English what? I mean, at this point, there's a lot of races in England. You know, white English, you know, racially English, because there isn't really such a thing as a. I mean, people can argue there's an English race, but when you actually study the history of the islands, there's been so much mixture of other peoples from France and other areas that it's what we now call France, by the way, that it's hard to say what the English race is, you know, also from Scandinavia. Anyway, so there's all that kind of silliness. But yeah, I get it. It's like, I mean, I thought the guy was fine, and I think he passes for a full Chinese person, kind of. And but yeah, I get it, because it's like you're making a movie called Crazy Rich Asians, and you're two lead of the two leads, only one of them is full Asian. Like, there's no other Chinese American or, you know, Chinese British actors available. Like, it just seems weird that you couldn't have found a full Asian guy. Like, there's got to be someone out there. Plus that Henry Golding, and I'm sure people are going to hate me for this, I didn't think he was that great of an actor. I mean, I thought he was fine. I thought he did a fine job, and maybe it was the writing and the directing, but he was really a subpar to Constance Wu. I mean, Constance Wu was just acting circles around this guy. And, you know, I don't know if it was that's how it was written or that's how he is, but there were so many moments when I just wanted to reach into the screen and grab this guy and either tell the character, you know, tell the writers, write this man some better lines, like give him life. Like, he's such a, I don't know, just a drip. I don't know. I mean, there were some scenes where some shit goes down and he's just like, oh, please stop. Oh no, don't do that. And it's like, you want your main character to like be like, you know, have a reaction of just like, no, you know, I don't know. But maybe that's how he's acting. Maybe that's how it was directed. Maybe that's how it was written. I don't know. It's also criticized. The movie is criticized for not representing all the races in Singapore. You know, it's mainly portraying people that are being said to be Chinese, even though not all of them are Chinese people. But, you know, there's a lot of other races in Singapore. You got Malaysian people and Indian people. In fact, there's a couple Indians that are portrayed in the movie, and they're portrayed as really scary and intimidating because they have their turbans on. So, yeah, I get it. But to me, it's like it's a rom-com about crazy rich Asians, and they happen to live in Singapore. I'm not sure why it even took place in Singapore. I mean, I know the skyline of Singapore is really over the top in some ways, so maybe that's why. I mean, it's like, why not just make them Chinese and put them in Singapore or something? I don't know. Maybe Singapore, or what I say, put them in Beijing or something, or Shanghai. But maybe Singapore is where all the rich Chinese people go. I don't know. But anyway, it's a rom-com. It's a silly rom-com about crazy rich Asians who happen to live in Singapore. And so, you know, I get that they didn't include other people. I mean, the movie, and one of the, you know, I don't know, sort of themes of the movie is that these people are stuck up rich people, that they are not particularly nice. I mean, even some of the good guys in this movie have scenes where you're like, oh, not so good, you know. Obviously privileged, you know. I saw someone writing about it. This is wealth porn. You know, that's a thing, right? It's a wealth porn movie where it's just like, look at how rich these people are and look how amazing the things that they can do. You know, like the bachelor party, it has to be the most over-the-top bachelor party of all time, right? And, you know, they go for it in that way. And it's supposed to be like, whoa. And that's another thing about movies like this that it just doesn't really appeal to me, is that I'm not materialistic in that way. I'm probably definitely materialistic, but I'm just not materialistic in the way that this movie portrays, like where it's like there's a scene at the bachelorette party where the bachelorette is like, she's like, and guess what? we get a free shopping spree at the local shopping village. They're on this like tropical island, and she's like, a free shopping spree, and it's like unironic, right? It's not they're not even making fun of her in the movie. It's just like supposed to be like, oh my god, that's so awesome that they have so much money that they can just do a free shopping spree, and it's not even at like a major store, like a expensive, like, I don't know what are expensive stores that people go to, but it's like they're on a village, they're in a tropical island. So it's just like island clothes. Like all those people, I'm guessing, could have afforded lots of things by themselves without making too much of a dent in their pocketbook, but somehow this shopping spree. And so that's a scene where everyone goes on a shopping spree and people are trying on clothes and da da da. And I'm just like, it's sort of like when I watched Sex in the City, the movie, there's a whole scene about shoes and stuff. And it's just like, it's not the materialism that I enjoy, anyway, so there's that. The last thing I'll say about this movie is, maybe the second to last thing I'll say is that there's two main storylines. You have the main storyline between the main characters, and then there's this totally secondary storyline that really has nothing to do with the main storyline. This was based on a book, so I'm guessing in the book there were several other stories involved, right? Because in books you can really explore lots of different storylines. Well, they decided to, in the movie, actually have one of these secondary storylines, and it was the most boring, melodramatic, badly written, badly acted, honestly, sequences. And they kept going back to it. The second time they went back, they went to the storyline. It's essentially about the lead guy's. He has a sister who is in kind of a troubled marriage, and the second time they went back to that storyline, I was like, oh, we're going back here? And I was like, okay, well, hopefully this is the last time we go back here. And then throughout the movie, they just keep going back to it, and it was so boring. It almost felt like a whole different movie to me. Even the lighting looked different. I was wondering, did the assistant director make these scenes, to make the production go faster or something? Because it felt like a whole different movie. Badly written, terribly acted. The guy, the sister is in this marriage with this guy, and the marriage isn't going well. And the guy is supposed to be like kind of nice, but kind of an asshole and insecure and all this kind of stuff. And he, I believe, is, English is not his native tongue. Like Henry Golding and Constance Wu, I believe Constance Wu, they grew up speaking English, you can tell. But when it comes to this character, he doesn't, which is great because this is supposed to be a movie about Chinese nationals, right? But so it'd be accurate. So that was another thing. It's like, this is interesting that there's no subtitles. There are very few subtitles in this movie. And because in reality, obviously, they wouldn't be speaking English as much, presumably. Anyway, so they, this guy, this asshole husband, he's really struggling with his lines, naturally, because he doesn't speak English that well. And one of the things that I hate about movies and TV shows that do this is you can tell like they really work with the actor to get them to be able to speak English well enough so that you can understand what they're saying. Because if they just said the lines, it would come across with too great of an accent and people in the audience wouldn't know what they're saying. Well, what ends up happening, from my estimation, is the actor is so bogged down by trying to speak words that they don't really know how to say, and they're over-focusing on their accent, and they're really trying hard to use the right vowel sounds. And because of that, they're not acting naturally. They're acting and speaking in this very unnatural way. Like, there's a way that people talk naturally in a language that is not theirs. Like, you know, you... you know, people do this all the time. Like you meet someone and they don't speak English. Say you speak, this is your native tongue, you speak English, you know, someone from France comes over and they, you know, they speak English kind of, and, you know, well enough to communicate, and they start talking with you. There's a certain cadence to the way they talk. And yeah, there's an accent, and yeah, their grammar isn't always great, and you know, it's fine, but there's a certain way that they talk that comes across as natural. Well, in movies and TV shows, I noticed that these actors they don't act like that. They're really using their brain power to make sure that they are using the right vowels, and it was just really comical, actually. I was just watching. I was like, ugh, could these scenes be any worse? Just like, and the lessons, you know, that are supposed to be taken away. I mean, there's one lesson that I think is fine. It's sort of a feminism lesson to it, which I liked. But there are also other lessons around, like, almost like praising materialism in some way, like and materialism on a level beyond, you know, normal materialism, like crazy rich materialism. You know, she has these earrings that are millions of dollars and they come into play. And I'm just like, so what's the lesson here? Like, yay for you that you have millions upon millions of dollars that you can just waste on jewelry that, you know, on a whim, and that's your identity. It was almost like, these rich earrings are the symbol of my independence or something. And I'm like, ugh, like the whole thing just, I just thought, like, did anyone watch these scenes and think maybe we should just cut them? Because the other thing is, the movie is 2 hours long. I mean, this is a rom-com, a very simple rom-com, and Hollywood just keeps making movies longer and freaking longer. And it has clearly several scenes that could have been cut easily, and it would have made the movie so much better. Honestly, like, if they got rid of those scenes, I probably would have given it a 7, because it would have moved faster. It would have focused on Constance Wu, who's great. The main storyline, you know, is get moving on that thing. And yeah, just this. So let me know if you've seen the movie. Let me know what you think about it, because maybe you're like, oh no, I love the secondary storyline because of this, and I like the acting, and I like this, da da da. You know, feel free to share your opinion. You're wrong, by the way. Just, you know, just want to preempt you on that. If you disagree with me, you're wrong fundamentally. Just joking. Okay. So in summary, Crazy Rich Asians, a fun movie, a good airplane movie, I'm guessing, a good Netflix movie. If you're Asian, you probably should go to the theater and see it. another kind of good result of this whole thing might be that Hollywood or the producers will realize, oh, we can make movies that focus on other sorts of people other than white people and still make a shit ton of money. How about we do that? And so there's that. In fact, this movie might have actually been made partially because they suspected it would do well in the Asian markets, which are, you know, emerging in the movie consumer market. So maybe they did it for that. I don't know. And also, if you run into me, you know, make sure you say, oh my God, you look like the guy from Crazy Rich Asians. And I'll be like, huh. Well, when the Twilight movies were popular, like when the first couple came out, I had a lot of people stop me on the street and say that I looked like the lead guy in Twilight. What's his name? Anyway, that guy. The guy from Harry Potter who died at the end of the fourth movie. And he's white. He's like a full-on white guy. And people are stopping me on the street and saying, oh my God, you look just like him. Because usually when people stop me on the street, they say I look like half Asian. It's like they will say I look like the guy from The Crow, Brandon Lee. He's half Chinese. Or they'll say I look like the guy who played The Crow in the TV show, who was also half Asian. Or they'll say I look like, is there anyone else? Anyway, so to be, have a more than one person stop me in the street and say, oh my God, you look just like that guy in Twilight. I was like, what in the world? And so I looked at his face and I think, again, it's the same kind of round head structure or sort of square skull structure with like cheekbones and like eyes that are kind of wide apart or big eyes. I don't know. I also sometimes get the Viper on Game of Thrones, Prince Oberyn, who was also in Narcos. Sometimes people say I look like him, which, you know, all these guys are good looking, by the way, so I suppose I should take it as a compliment in that way, for sure. You know, things will take a turn for me when people are like, oh my God, you look just like Mr. Miyagi from Karate Kid. yeah, it's interesting getting old. That's one thing. You know, one day I guess I'll look like Mr. Miyagi or some other old guy. All right. Well, that does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining me out there. Oh, no. I wanted to actually keep wanting to end this podcast. I wanted to briefly go over other things I've been watching. I watched the Vietnam War documentary that came out last year. It's on Netflix by Ken Burns and a woman who worked with him. I can't remember her name. Awesome documentary, the Vietnam War. One of the best documentaries I've ever seen, because because it goes into American politics, it goes into Vietnamese politics, it interviews North Vietnamese army people, you know, communist Viet Cong. It really humanizes the whole thing, man. It's just a really, really great movie. I rewatched Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, the one where they go to San Francisco and back in time and they get the whales. Charming as always, but did we have different standards of film back in 1986? I mean, there are some real rough moments in that movie that we must have forgiven. I saw Mission Impossible Fallout with Tom Cruise, and I gave it a 5 out of 10. It was good. It was okay. It's not amazing. It's fun. I might give it maybe a 6, you know. Good action movie. Nothing interesting happened. You know, it doesn't stick with you. As soon as it's over, you just walk away. You're like, okay, that was fun. Yeah. I think the Mission Impossible movies have always been good in that they don't fall into the James Bond problem. Like the new James Bond movies, I consider them to be way too self-important. I mean, the new James Bond movies are just like totally opposite of what the old James Bond movies used to be. The old James Bond movies were just like, were like the Mission Impossible movies, where it's just like you got this action guy at the center and you have action and intrigue and costumes and nice suits and you just go for it and nothing complicated. The new James Bond movies, I find to just be annoyingly self-important. Like they're trying to make it all kind of gritty and angry and super heady. And it's just like, God, get over yourself. I saw a great movie, Thank You for Your Service, came out last year. It stars Miles Teller, if you know him from a lot of great movies. I'm trying to remember the different movies that he's been in. But Thank You for Your Service, I gave it an 8 out of 10. It's a movie about it's a true story, actually, about three Iraq veterans who come back from the war. And it is interesting. It is educational about post-traumatic stress disorder. It is educational on, oh, this is what it's really like to be a vet. I have vet friends who, one of whom died in Afghanistan. And I just found this movie to be really interesting, compelling, a very powerful story. So if I recommend one of these movies, Thank You for Your Service. Incredibles 2, saw that, 7 out of 10. Fun movie. Love all Pixar. Love Incredibles 1. Incredibles 2 was not as good as Incredibles 1, but definitely had some amazing moments. I mean, that Jack-Jack, the baby, is just a hilarious character. Saw Jurassic World, Fallen Kingdom. Gave it a 4 out of 10. It's not good, but fine to watch, but not good. Molly's Game, finally watched that movie. I gave it a 6 out of 10. Pretty interesting. I could have bumped it up to a 7, maybe. It's an Aaron Sorkin movie. You can't go wrong. Saw Pacific Rim, the new one, Uprising. Did not like it. Gave it a 3 out of 10. Thought it was... The first Pacific Rim movie was kind of like... it was good. The first Pacific Rim movie a few years ago was great because it was so straightforward. Like, it's basically a Transformers movie without all the stupid stuff. Like, the Transformers movies have a same problem as, like, the James Bond movies. Like, the Transformer movies are trying to be so self-important and just trying to, like, super elaborate situations, where Pacific Rim just said, okay, you got big monsters coming up out of the sea attacking the cities, and then you got humans who put themselves in these giant robots and they just battle it out. It's just that simple. There's no bells. It's just nothing other than that. And so Pacific Rim was really refreshing because it was like, oh, okay, that was fun, you know, and it got high ratings, I think, because of that, even for me. But then Pacific Rim Uprising, it's just like, okay, that again, but not as good, like not nearly as good. So there's all that stuff. I watched the 1517 to Paris. I gave it a 5 out of 10. This is a true story directed by Clint Eastwood about these veterans or military guys who are traveling around Europe, and they're in Paris, and a terrorist gets on. This is a real story. A terrorist enters a train. They're on a train, passenger car, and the terrorist has guns and bombs and stuff. And these three American military guys tackle him and detain him before he can kill anybody else. And it's just this really heroic situation. And the movie stars the actual dudes who did it. Clint Eastwood, if I'm understanding right, he Clint Eastwood actually, in the movie got the actual guys. And so the movie starts off with them in training, and then they're traveling around Europe and they're interacting and they're meeting people. And it's just a lot of kind of bros interacting with each other. And I just found the movie to be just boring until the action. And then the end, there's the, 15 minute sequence in which the terrorist tries to kill people on the train. And that's fascinating. That whole scene is really interesting. But the rest of the movie, I just thought to be just like, you had a great premise of like, okay, I want to make a movie about this event that happened. But then whoever had to write this script had to like write an interesting script up until that moment. And there just wasn't anything interesting. It was a fine story for a documentary for sure, but not for a, 2 hour movie. Watched Ali Wong's new, Netflix special, Hard Knock Life, on Netflix. And I was crying. It was so funny at certain points. Ali Wong is hilarious. 8 out of 10. I've probably talked with you about everything else. Oh my God. So, Tommy Wiseau, right? From The Room. Well, he and Greg Sestero got together to make another movie recently, and they released it, and so we went to our artsy theater here in Seattle and watched it. It's called Best Friends, and it is a sort of I thought it was interesting. I gave it a 3 out of 10 because it's not a good movie, but I thought there were some interesting scenes. So for you Wiseau fans out there, you've probably already seen it. There's certain parts of it that are just like, oh, is this sort of emulative of their real life? I don't know. What else can I talk about here? I've probably already talked for too long. So let's wrap it up. That does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining me. Please take care of yourself because you deserve it. You really, really do.